as something that's wrong. But maybe so many of our diseases are actually the body's intelligence saying we're actually doing something wrong as a culture. We're actually, when we're feeling depressed and anxious, maybe it's because we're not meant to be or live like automatons, and that we're just dousing ourselves in antidepressants and numbing agents when the body is trying to say, hey, like, get back in line with life's rhythms.
What's up, my friend? My name is Ted Rice, and today I'm coming to you from Bali, Indonesia, where we've been having an amazing time. And by we, I mean, of course, my wife Giselle and I. And if you're new to this show, you may not know, but my wife and I, we've been traveling the world, mostly through Southeast Asia, exploring different countries and just growing as people and experiencing different cultures and learning about them and learning about their health approaches and their rituals and so many other things. And that's why I'm super excited to share with you this episode today. I have Joshua Fields on the show today. Now, he's the executive director of a global community called Consciousness Hacking that is in over 50 cities working on building frameworks and contexts for cutting-edge tools for transformation. And that's what Consciousness Hacking is really about, consciousness hacking, the idea, the concept. And we're going to be talking about that today and how you can do it. So if you're interested in things like biohacking or transcranial direct stimulation or just the future of how technology is going to help us with our health and navigate this new world of technology and digital information that we're in, this podcast is for you. You're going to learn a lot. And Joshua, he's a really interesting guy. He's a former analyst from Morgan Stanley and a Scottish amateur boxer. And he also is an Oxford-trained economist. So he has a very interesting background, of course, in finances. So if you're a high-performance person in the financial community, you're going to connect with his story right away. However, he left that to do what he's doing now. And we're going to get into this idea of consciousness hacking and talking about what a lot of us feel like is going on in society, but nobody's really talking about it. So we're going to dive into all of this and more on today's episode. And it's going to be a bit different than my typical episodes, but I think it's one that is going to make a big impact on you, and it's going to help you navigate through today's world. So if you enjoy this episode, then I'd ask for you, please share this episode with someone you care about or someone who you think this message will resonate with. And if you're new to this show, well, welcome. This is kind of different than what we usually do. We usually dive into the nuts and bolts and details of mindset and health and fitness and everything that goes into that, because this show is all about upgrading your mind and your body. So if you're looking to make a breakthrough in your health and level up your life, you're in the right place. So make sure you subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts so that every time one of my episodes goes live, you'll be the first to know. All right, without further ado, let's step into this conversation about consciousness hacking and technology with Joshua Fields. Joshua Fields, thanks so much for coming on and speaking with us today.
Hey, Ted, great to be here, man.
Yeah, really excited to dive into our conversation. You are part of this consciousness hacking movement, this revolution that's happening, but you have an unusual backstory where you're an Oxford-trained economist, but you've transitioned out of that into what you're doing now, which is talking about consciousness hacking, meditation, all these other things. Can we start first with, how would you define consciousness hacking for someone who's never heard that term before?
Sure. So I want to make, there's a distinction between consciousness hacking the company, which is what I'm currently running, and consciousness hacking as a kind of broad term. So consciousness hacking as a broad term is really the question, how do we accelerate the transformation of the human mind? So what are the tools, strategies, and techniques that we can use to shift people's state of consciousness? And Consciousness Hacking, the organization, which is a global community based in 50 cities across the globe, is in particular, what are the cutting edge tools and technologies we can use to facilitate this shift in human consciousness? So for example, when people speak about hacking consciousness, they think about things like breath work, psychedelics, fasting. What we're really interested in is hacking consciousness from the perspective of modern technology, the latest and novel means of altering the human mind through hardware and software.
Well, that is that's going to be interesting to dive into, because I know that's super hot right now. Everybody's looking to technology for what or how it can level up their life. So I'm really excited to dive into it. Before we do that, you have, like I mentioned earlier, a really interesting story where you were a former analyst for Morgan Stanley, but you're also a Scottish amateur boxer, and you transitioned from that into leading consciousness hacking, this global community that you talked about. What exactly were the steps that led you from the world of finance to what you're doing now?
So to reframe that question, as some of my friends back home frame it, like, Josh, what on earth happened to you? So I was in investment banking, and to be perfectly frank, I was pretty unfulfilled, Ted. I had achieved everything that I was meant to achieve for someone in their 20s. You know, I had an Oxford degree, a high-paying banking job, a fancy car, and a lovely flat in the city of London. And yet I was nervous, I was anxious, I was insecure, and I had this deep understanding that nothing was ever going to be enough, that I'd been climbing this ladder of success from the age of like 13. And I noticed that it's often called now like hedonic adaptation, that as soon as I had received the thing that brought me achievement and pleasure and success, that kind of instantaneous hit of performance, I was up for like 2 weeks. And then it was like, okay, back to the drawing board. What is the next thing I can achieve? And I saw that happening in my career. And I looked at people, you know, 10 years above me on the ladder. And I thought, I don't want to be that guy. Like, I don't want to be there. Like, surely there's something more to life than just climbing this perpetual ladder of corporate. And so I left and I went on a bit of a journey. And I realized through things like meditation that the thing that I'd been seeking wasn't actually an achievement. The thing that I was seeking, and I think to some degree we are all seeking, is actually a state of mind. And things like meditation and dream work and other things actually brought me closer to that state of mind than anything that I had done in the corporate world or in the achievement domain had ever brought me. And so I decided to dedicate my life to it and say, hey, like, this is actually what so many of us are looking for but lacking. And that took me out to San Francisco. After a couple of years hiatus of meditating in caves in India and trekking the jungles of Peru, and here I am trying to really give scale and give access to these higher states of being. Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I'll tell you, it's such a common story, that the one that you're sharing with us, where people are on this treadmill, like you said, they get a win. Maybe it's a raise, maybe it's a bonus, maybe it's buying a new car, maybe it's buying a new house, but it doesn't last. That happiness, that state of mind, like you said, where we feel fulfilled and content and feel like we've really leveled up. It's like an endless game that never leads you to that place where you feel like, wow, I've really accomplished a lot here. And it leads a lot of people to a dark place if they play that game long enough and look back on their life and feel like, you know, what the hell was I doing there? And so what I want to ask you are, I went through, or still going through, kind of a disconnection from my culture where I've traveled through Thailand and all of Southeast Asia. I'm in Indonesia right now. And you see people who are really happy, who from a Western perspective, you're like, why are you so happy? You live in this small little house and you don't have much. And, you know, why are you so happy? And I think a lot of people would have, I don't know, a bit of a paradigm shock if they saw some of the people in these areas, and I'm sure what you saw in India. And so what I'm kind of asking you is, what was the thing for you when you were traveling through India, through Peru, all the other travels, the thing that stood out to you that really shifted the way that you looked at the culture that you grew up in?
Yeah, I love how you've used travel as the gateway into this question, because I think it says it's actually been a huge part of my journey. And there's a bit of a cliched traveler meme, you know, like of gap year and that kind of thing that's disseminated online. But I think there's a very profound truth to be found, to be had, in the sense that when you detach yourself from your incumbent culture and you travel the world, you begin to realize for the first time that there are actually different ways of participating with life. And that the ways of life that we are so accustomed to in the West, of consumerism, of climbing the social dominance hierarchy, of corporations and startups, that it can be easy to think that this is the only way to do this thing. And then when you extract yourself from the dominant culture and you say, hey, like, there are different ways of being, you start to think, ah, well, maybe I don't have to play this game. Maybe there are different ways to play the game. And I think traveling really gave me a sense of, yeah, there's people who are reaching levels of fulfillment and meaning, but they're not working 60 hours a week. You know, they're putting more priority on different aspects of life. And I think that if you don't have that opportunity to travel, it's very hard to understand and empathize with that, because you're in your fishbowl, you're in your goldfish bowl. How do you know what's outside the bowl if you've only ever been swimming in your own water? So travel has been a huge piece. And in terms of specifics,
are you there, Joshua?
I'm there. I'm there. I'm pausing to reflect.
Oh, sorry.
I'm trying to think. There's okay. There's something about nature that's huge, that we're living in these like huge metropolis cities, and we're so disconnected from something that is so core to us. And so when you go somewhere like Thailand, I mean, and you're deeply embedded in natural ecosystems, the body kind of remembers. I don't know if you agree with this, but there's a kind of sense in the body that's like, aha, like this feels to my nervous system to be like the right thing.
I agree 100%.
So there's a big piece of nature to, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, there's even, not that I need research to tell me everything or validate everything that I know, but it's nice to have it. And there's even research coming out of, I guess, that started in Japan with forest bathing and just how powerful it is. And it goes beyond just, oh, I'm looking at trees. It's the experience, and I can't wait to dive into this with you, but the experience of being in nature where you're actually inhaling certain chemicals, there's just something that you get from being in nature that you just cannot get from being in New York City or London or San Francisco or whatever city that you're in where you're disconnected from things. Have you heard of biophilic design?
I mean, I've heard of biomimicry, so I can imagine what biophilic design is. Yeah.
Yeah. This idea that we're, instead of trying to live in an urban area without any green, try to bring that back into the urban area. So actually designing buildings. I haven't been to Singapore yet, but apparently they're one of the leading, that's one of the places that's leading this idea of bringing green back into urban spaces. And I could see how that would be huge eventually, but I think about the place, the office that most of the people who are listening to this show probably go to work in, and it's probably closed off from natural light. Probably if there is a plant, it's a fake one, you know? And it's just this powerful thing that.
So let's just take, missing. If you just.
What's that, Josh?
I'm just saying, if you take a very evolutionary biology perspective, we've lived in forests for quite literally millions of years as a species. And, you know, Homo sapiens came around a couple hundred thousand years ago from our ancestors. And it's only within the last 300 to 400 years, if that, that we've started living in these urban civilized areas disconnected from nature. So if you think about it, we've spent a tiny fraction of our lives embedded within of our species lineage embedded in these concrete jungles, and so our bodies aren't actually adapted. Like our bodies still have the same mammalian and reptilian tendencies and desires in our brains and our bodies that we did hundreds of thousands of years ago, and so it makes perfect sense. You know, I don't think design should be biophilic. Like, I think biophilia, now that you've told me the term, is actually should be in essence a superfluous prefix. Reason being, surely all our design should be in line with life's natural rhythms, and even things like artificial light, right? We don't think anything of artificial light when there's a bunch of research now that shows that, you know, it's really messing up with our melatonin production at night, and that red light itself is so much better. So, yeah, we need to realign ourselves with nature's pulsations. And that's not hippie stuff. It's very, very, very rational.
Yeah. And I guess people like you and me and the other people who are listening right now who are hip to that are just nodding their heads. But it's the people who maybe are having like, oh, well, you know, it's because if you grow up a certain way, you grow up with electric light, you grow up with, you know, kids are now growing up with the internet and social media. If you grew up living in a city, like you said earlier, you don't know anything different, even though a lot of research is coming out and it's, you know, evolutionary biology is saying, hey, listen, you know, there's a gene environment mismatch here where your genes just don't respond to a loud, noisy, concrete, dead environment full of artificial light and artificial food. How would you help someone who maybe isn't sold on that idea or embodying that idea, to use a term that I know you and I both like, who doesn't embody that feeling like, oh, I really need to reconnect here with what makes a human be and what makes me feel good?
No, that's a great question. Like, how do we sell what is essentially a deeper natural truth to those who have been so disconnected? I think there's an invitation for someone to say, hey, like, would you be willing to spend 2 days in nature and just take note of how you feel when you go in and then when you come out? Like, how are your mind patterns? What does your body feel like? Is there as much tension? And I think a big part of this, Ted, is actually getting in touch with the sensitivities of our body. So through meditation practice, and even to some degree through embodied movement like dance or martial arts, we become more aware of the signaling mechanisms that the body is trying to give to the mind. I'm tense here. I'm relaxed here. Interesting. When I'm in nature, my shoulders drop. When I'm in a big city, my shoulders are up at my ears. These are these physiological markers of stress that have become so normalized because really they're habitual and they're ubiquitous in big cities. We're all living in these fight, flight, highly traumatized, highly acutely stressed modes of being. And so I think my invitation would be to someone, hey, like, use a practice to get in touch with your body, know what signals your body is telling you, and then discern from there, okay, do I feel more stressed in nature, less stressed in nature? When I go for a swim, is my heart rate, you know, slowing down versus you know, just get it really honoring and listening to what the body is trying to tell us. Because this is the thing, this is where I think so many people, our Western medical system is so pathological, because it treats the symptoms of the body as something that's wrong. But maybe so many of our diseases are actually the body's intelligence saying we're actually doing something wrong as a culture. We're actually, when we're feeling depressed and anxious, maybe it's because we're not meant to be or live like automatons, and that we're just dousing ourselves in antidepressants and numbing agents when the body is trying to say, hey, like, get back in line with life's rhythms.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. Even just when you look at the data, the types of diseases that westernized countries come down with tend to be these inflammatory diseases. And you're starting to see that the world over as modernization starts to take hold. And the thing is, what does a person do who's listening right now? Let's talk to one person, a person who's listening. Maybe they're aware. They're like, yeah, okay, going out in nature would be great, but I've got a job that I go to. It's a bit soul-sucking and I'm not aligned with it, but I've got to pay my mortgage. I've got a couple kids that I'm raising. You know, I'd love to take them out, but we have all these other things that I have to do on the weekend, and I'd love to meditate and get more in touch with my body, but I'm already exercising and my time is so limited. I guess it does come back to that thing, that idea that time is limited. What would you say to a person who's perhaps struggling, who's on board with what you're saying, but just having trouble implementing it in the context of their life?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm extremely empathic and sensitive to this concern, because it's a little bit of a luxury to say, hey, I'm just going to go out and take a 10-day Vipassana retreat. See you later.
Exactly. World. Right. You know?
And this is exactly the problem that consciousness hacking is trying to solve for. How do people wake up to life's natural intelligence, given the parameters of a hyper-westernized, capitalized, 21st century modern system? Because standard practices ain't going to cut it. But they could for some people, but they're not going to scale because people have responsibilities. And so we're trying to solve for this. How do we build tools that meet people where they're at, so that instead of having to spend 1 hour in meditation every morning, we can actually create hardware and software that personalizes interventions in such a way that you can accrue just as many benefits in, say, 15 or 20 minutes. Now, that's not necessarily meaning these are shortcuts, but rather they're more effective and efficient personalized interventions given where you're at. So we're working on this. So, for example, a technology-augmented meditation device is something called the Muse headband, M-U-S-E. Which gives you biofeedback entrainment, which basically shows you when you're in a meditative state and when you're out of a meditative state. And it does this via an app on your phone. So that's one example. If you want to create an ecosystem in your home that is more akin to that of nature, for example, replace all your artificial LED lights with red light. Red light is massively important for melatonin production vis-a-vis blue light. And it also has health benefits for mitochondria and the skin and things like that. Other things that you can do are by filter, have a water filter in your home, absolutely. And also sleep on an electromagnetic field mat. So often they're called PEMF, but have one of those under your bed so that you're not actually picking up all of the Wi-Fi, 4G, 5G signals that are surrounding you in modern cities. And they're actually shown to have really damaging effects on metabolism and the way that information is processed in your body. And then there's also just bringing plants into your home. You know, make your house a haven for nature itself. And so that combination of water, light, the blocking of harmful rays, and bringing plants into your house can go some way to mitigate some of the negative impacts of living in a city. And if you can stack that with
the latest and greatest technological advances for things like body awareness, like the Muse headset, then you run with a chance of actually overcoming some of modern society's ills.
Yeah, solid recommendations. And what I'd love to ask is, well, I have not used the Muse, although I've heard great things about it. I have an Oura Ring that helps me dial in my sleep, and it's one of the things that I use with my coaching clients who have sleep issues. And I was wondering, what are the top, say, technological tools that, besides the Muse, that you would use or recommend that people try out?
So the stuff that we're really working on is probably 5 to 10 years, or the stuff that we're really interested in is probably 5 to 10 years away from being consumer applicable. So I'm not going to be able to give any like real specific recommendations for consciousness hacking technologies per se right now that are that I think a standard that's really good enough to shift how you feel. From a red light perspective, there's the Joovv light, J-O-O-V. And then for the water perspective, is the big Berkey water filters, B-E-R-K-E-Y. And to be honest, man, I also do use some polar HRV stuff. So heart rate variability is a very, very good indicator of physiological stress levels. And you can download various apps on your phone. I forget what mine is called. To basically track where your heart rate variability is throughout the day. And you wear a heart rate monitor. And it's a really good indicator of whether or not you should exercise in the morning. And also whether or not you're getting fitter. The lower your heart rate variability, the less fit and the more prone to stress people tend to be. So yeah, those are my kind of staples. The Muse headband, the Joovv red light, a really good water filter, and some sort of device that's measuring my progress along HRV.
Yeah, all great stuff. Yeah, I get my HRV from my Oura Ring, but I only get it at night. I don't get it during the day. I played around with an HRV monitor during my workouts or testing it in the morning and using it during my workouts with, are you familiar with Joel Jameson?
No.
Okay. So yeah, it's definitely interesting information. And like you said, it's a indicator of your physiological stress load. Just curious, like as far as these things that you're working on, because I'll just say it like this, Joshua. One of the issues is like, I've tried some of these things. Now, I haven't tried Muse, like I said, but I've tried some of the technological hacks that people have been talking about. And I haven't felt like, other than what you've just mentioned, I haven't felt like it was that big of a deal. And so it feels like this could be a big deal, but it's just not there yet. And could you just share a little bit about maybe what's on the horizon that consciousness hacking that your company is working on?
Yeah, so we're not building the devices per se, but we're really trying to provide the ecosystem by which the most incredible entrepreneurs, ideas, and startups can really flourish. Because ultimately, it's all good and well having a good idea and a good company, but if you don't have the ecosystem and the awareness to support it, it means nothing. So one example of a very interesting intervention that I really think is going to take the world by storm is something called ultrasonic neuromodulation. And if you put that into Google, there's a neuroscientist called Jay Sanguinetti. And in short, what that is very, it's a very short burst of sound waves into a very specific part of the brain. And what we're finding, what Jay and other guys are finding through this, is that in targeting specific areas of the brain, including the posterior cingulate cortex, which is the PCC, which is the back of the head, and is thought to be responsible for a lot of self-narrative, that if we just put 30-second bursts of sound waves into parts of the brain like that, we can actually quieten down the mind to almost a point of zero state. And so, for example, I did ultrasonic neuromodulation last week, and for about 16 hours after a single intervention, I was in what you could say is a very deep state of contemplation. And this is very early. You know, within 10 years, we're going to be able to get more accurate. Then you have things like, there's a company called Trip, T-R-I-P-P, and they're doing psychedelic experiences in virtual reality. And I've tried this also. So you move into a psychedelic VR state, and after 20 minutes of wearing the VR headset, in which you're exploring deeply visual and beautiful and relaxing worlds, you take the headset off and you're in a much, much deeper place of relaxation. So that's actually available to buy. You can actually get Trip, I think. So yeah, there's lots of interesting things on the horizon, but I absolutely agree with you that a lot of the stuff out there in the market right now, other than Muse and a couple of other things, they're very average. Very, very average, but that's not going to be for long.
Interesting. Yeah. It's this curious time that we're in where it's like, wow, technology is so exciting. And then you experience it and you're just like, okay.
Meh.
Exactly. But you know that it's going to get better. And you're just wondering when that point is where it's going to be a big breakthrough. So you think that's going to be in 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, for it to be disseminated on a relatively universal basis, yeah, 5 to 10 years away from like really good stuff getting out there. And then there's also the biotech world, right? So actually between my banking days and my consciousness days, I was working on exogenous ketone esters. I don't know if you're aware.
I am, but have never taken them.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a very big biotech breakthrough that we can actually almost instantaneously put our bodies into a state of ketosis through drinking a certain liquid. Now, there's a lot of ketogenic salts, exogenous ketone salts out there, which aren't so good for the system because basically in order to get the ketones, you've got to actually take a shitload of, sodium chloride. Is that the salt?
Yeah, sodium chloride.
So anyway, salt, that's salt. So it's been a while since my chemistry days from school.
Not a problem.
And So you're taking those, but what's really interesting is ketone esters, where you don't actually need the salt and you can basically just take good old ketones straight. And there's a company in the US that I know quite well called Human HVMN, and they are selling the world's first ketone ester shot. It's very expensive. It's like $33 a shot, but triathletes, cyclists are using this to get into better states of ketosis. And this is the amazing thing about exogenous ketones is that you can actually be in a carb-rich state, right? And also be in ketosis at the same time.
Mm.
Whereas obviously, if you want to get into ketosis, usually you've got to deplete yourself of carbs for days on end. So biotech is interesting. Synthetic biology is interesting. Transformative technology is interesting. But we're very much at the start of these exponential curves.
Yeah. And it is an exciting time to be in, and I'll have to try. You piqued my interest. Maybe I got to try some exogenous ketones. I know that, I don't want to turn this into a talk about the ketogenic diet, but I was listening to Keith Barr, who's a really brilliant researcher, and he was talking about how going into doing something where you cyclically are in ketosis can help with your mitochondria a lot and prevent some of the aging that people are experiencing as a degradation of these mitochondria. Also, aerobic exercise is another way to do that. But for people who are just to have a big aversion to doing that, cyclical keto can help. And so if you don't even have to get into ketosis by restricting carbs, which some people will have a problem doing, like myself, I start getting high levels of anxiety, probably due to not enough tryptophan getting into the brain to create serotonin, melatonin, etc. But let's change this direction a little bit. I want to talk to you about, you wrote this crazy article. It's not crazy. It's just a combination. It's well argued, is what I should call it. It's called "Is Civilization on the Verge of Collapse?" And I'll link it in the show notes for this episode. And I don't want to talk too much about it because it's very deep and very well researched. And you come at it through your economic background, and you can tell like you put a lot into this. But what I think might be helpful for people is, especially for the people right now who look at some of the situations with politics and some of the other, I guess, things that they see in the media that are distressing them. In fact, some research was showing that Americans in particular, I don't know how it is in Great Britain, but Americans in particular are, a lot of the stress comes from not just our lives, our daily lives, but it's coming from feeling uncertain about the political situation in the States. It's coming from, you know, all these things that they're being bombarded with by the media. And you kind of make the argument in your article, like, you kind of say, hey, listen, you know, here are all these perspectives on what causes societies to collapse. And it seems like we're on the precipice of something. Now, you don't fully go and say that it's going to happen. And you kind of put it in perspective and say, you know, who knows, right? It's really hard to predict the future. But can you just talk a little bit about that? And then we'll get into some, I guess, motivation for people and some practical steps that they can take.
Sure. So I know this is a podcast predominantly around like health and lifestyle. And I actually think these two issues are deeply intertwined. And I'll get onto that in a little second. But anyway, I spent the last 18 months or so researching how and why civilizations fail. And I found that there were some patterns between our current predicament and the civilizations that have come before us that were on the verge of collapse. And let me just give you three of those factors. The first one is complexity. So there's an anthropologist called Joseph Tainter, who wrote in the 80s that civilizations collapse when they fail to account for increasing levels of complexity. That as a society grows, as its populations grows, as its economics becomes more difficult, it adds layers and layers of bureaucracy in order to better make sense of its problems. But what happens is to such an extent, when that level of complexity gets to such a degree, the marginal benefit of adding more layers of complexity is actually lower than the marginal cost. And so it makes economic sense to actually regress to more simple forms of complexity. Because if you the cost of adding per unit of energy, of adding more complexity, is less than the benefits gained from that increase of socio-political complexity. Now, basically he says, if things get too complex and we can't handle it, a society fails. So where are we with complexity at the moment? Well, as you can tell from the polarization of politics in America, the Brexit situation, the EU and the UK, we're at bureaucratic deadlock. That our socio-political mechanisms aren't actually able to make decisions. There's too much bureaucracy, there's too much polarization. Moreover, our ability on an individual level to handle complexity is depleting. Why? Well, our attention spans are going down, but most importantly is this rise of fake news. It's actually degrading the quality of the information that's inhabiting our system. And if you think about it this way, Ted, if I'm an organism and I can't trust the information that is coming into my perceptive field, then I'm an organism destined for failure. So we have increasing socio-political complexity and a regression in our individual capacity to handle complexity because we can't trust the information coming in. Now, you add into that an exponential technology curve and positive feedback loops from our ecological catastrophe of which we have no idea what's going to happen. You know, the IPCC report with a 2-degree carbon projections doesn't actually take into account the positive feedback loops of what actually happens when there's less ice in the Arctic pole. And so you have ecological complexity, runaway technological complexity, runaway socio-political complexity, juxtaposed with our inability to handle complexity That is the recipe for disaster if any of the history books are to go by. So number one is complexity.
Right.
Let me speak very simply to the other two. The other two is there's a guy called Sir John Glubb, who showed that over time, societies go through seven stages of civilization. The first is the age of triumph, where warriors take over the kingdom and things like integrity, honor, and truth are core values. Societies end in something called the age of decadence. Now, guess what happens in the age of decadence? Truth is lost from public discourse. Materialism and narcissism set in as the main value systems. And celebrities win the core positions of power. Does this sound familiar?
Absolutely, yeah. It's so funny, though, that it's this is from a long time ago, even though it's...
This was 1972.
What I mean is his research is on all these other cultures that have been around, long gone, for example, but it's happening now, and it's just a different iteration. It didn't matter that they didn't have... what I'm trying to say is it didn't matter that they didn't have social media or any of the other things that we look at. It's really about us, not the technology that exists at the time, is, I guess, the point I was making.
Yeah, exactly. These are just patterns. Like, nature exists in patterns, and we, in our human hubris, think we have stepped out of the patternings of nature. We're not. We're just another expression of a pattern with fancier inventions and fancier language. This is a pattern. So whether or not let me get onto this piece here. We have this exponential curve upwards in terms of how we're improving. We have technological innovation. We have, you know, life extension. We're bringing people out of poverty at such a rapid rate. But we also have an exponential curve that is decreasing. We have biodiversity loss. We have environmental degradation. And so this conjunct of an exponential curve that's making things better and an exponential curve that's making things worse, how are those things both true at the same time? Well, what that is indicative of in a living system is if you have extremes going both ways, is essentially that system is destabilizing. Now, the question we have now is, does that destabilization of the system lead from caterpillar to butterfly? In other words, are we shifting upwards as a species? Or is this indicative of a phase shift, as Daniel Schmachtenberger says, a phase shift downwards, which is basically caterpillar to nothing?
Mm-mm.
That remains to be seen. And what we do and how we show up is in large part going to determine whether or not we survive what comes next.
just only that. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a very anxiety-producing thought, and you know, you're making a strong argument here, and also in that article that you wrote that I shared to several people, and they thought it was thought-provoking. For sure, because of some of the things that you say. Let's take this part now, this opportunity now, rather, to just maybe talk about like some things that people can do that we already have been talking about, but just understanding, like, someone may listen to you say this, Joshua, and say, you know what? Oh man, the complexity, the Donald Trump is president. He's a reality TV star. Oh, you know, it's just, someone might be going crazy and also feeling very powerless because what can you do? What can you do about the exponential technology increase? Nothing as a person. What can you do about Donald Trump except cast your vote every 4 years? Not much, you know? Arguing about it on Facebook or Twitter or wherever, it just doesn't lead to any sort of meaningful change. But I know you believe in this because you said it in the article that you wrote, and it's something that I believe in too, is that change starts with the individual. And it's about us taking responsibility for our actions, for the way we live our lives, for showing up the best way we can. So Could you share your perspective on that and talk about maybe inspire someone who's listening right now to stop giving their power away to these icons in the media and really focus on themselves?
Yeah, so there's various ways to approach this. One is to hear this narrative and be in complete denial and just say, you, sir, there have been apocalyptic stories for centuries and you were just another one of those false prophets proclaiming the doomsday scenario. So there's denial. Then there's accept. Then there's a grief. There's powerlessness, like you said, which is, well, I can't do anything about it, so what's the point? But there's a very, very small slither of something in between, which I speak from experience, that I've gone between both of these poles, but I've also gone through grief. Like the grief of fully inhabiting, like, oh my God, like things are going to change very, very dramatically. And that led to hopelessness in my own body and despair. But it was in the sitting with that hopelessness and despair that actually I came to a breakthrough, which is that, well, how would I live my life today as if I knew I had no tomorrow? And so I think there is a certain call to duty, a certain call to action that says, okay, let's say shit, we're about to hit the fan. How would I be preparing? And the answer is, I'd be preparing by making myself the most anti-fragile, resilient individual known to man. Now, guess what? If I happen to train myself and my mind and my body to be a real warrior of the human spirit, and things don't collapse, then Jesus Christ, I'm still in a much better position than ever was. What if I treated the person that I met today in a way that was so loving and caring and present, and the world, and they didn't die tomorrow? My interactions and my relationships would still be exponentially better. So this is the call. It's to say, how do we actually up-level who we are and what we will become if there's going to be collapse? And even if there's not going to be collapse, would that not just make a better society in general? And so the way I show up is, let's create anti-fragility. How do we make ourselves intentionally uncomfortable in knowing that discomfort actually leads to growth? How do we take on a more stoic philosophy? I mean, I'm a big, big fan of stoicism as a philosophy, and people should read, like, you know, Seneca or Marcus Aurelius to show that there are different techniques and exercises, like imagining this is the last day you're going to live, that from one level of consciousness seem morbid, and yet from another level of consciousness allow us to prepare for the catastrophe that life will inevitably bring us at some point through grief, death, loss, whatever. And for me, meditation is a huge part of that. It allows us to sit with our craving and not react, and our aversion and not react. And this in Buddhism is the source of how we transcend suffering, to not react to craving or aversion.
Wow. That's powerful, Joshua. Yeah. And man, you know, you're making a good point. If you do take this seriously and level yourself up, either way, you end up better for it. Whether something.
So does your relationship. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. No, great point, man. And I think that's a powerful point to end things on, because we've talked about a lot here. And yeah, it's just something that I think we're all kind of feeling or wondering about, like, how much longer can this craziness go on, right? And I think there's something we all kind of realize, like, you know, something's going to change, whether that change is going to be, like you said, going back from a caterpillar to nothing or from a caterpillar to butterfly remains to be seen. And perhaps we all can influence that by taking personal responsibility. But I think we all feel like something's going to be changing, right? So,
yep. So, absolutely.
So thank you so much, man, for coming on today, for sharing your wisdom, your perspective, and how we can all level ourselves up to improve what we see out there, to take our power back.
pleasure, Ted, and great chatting. I enjoyed this very much.
And where would you like people to go to learn more about the company Consciousness Hacking, or your personal blog, Neonosis?
Sure. So the Consciousness Hacking, you can find us on Facebook. Just type in Consciousness Hacking, or you can go to our website, which is Cohack, cohack.life. And I had an old blog and podcast from last year called Neonosis, NEONOSIS, which is the juxtaposition of two words, neo meaning new and gnosis meaning knowledge, new knowledge. And I've been relatively quiet on the writing front recently, but hope to get back into it at some point soon.
Great. And also with Consciousness Hacking, this is all over the world in 50 cities. In fact, I looked, there's one in Miami, which I'm originally from. Unfortunately, I didn't know about it until I actually moved out of Miami. But there's also a group in Ubud, Bali, Indonesia, where I'm at now. So this is something.
To be honest, I mean, please, if you can find the organizers in Ubud, reach out, go for tea, go for coffee. I mean, this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to connect hearts, heads, and souls throughout the world. And if you are interested in this intersection of how do we build tools to up-level humanity, and you want to build community and a crew around it, and you live in any part of the world, reach out to us. Go onto the website, cohack.life. And we'll make sure that you're aligned and you can start a meetup anywhere. We launched in Tokyo last month. We're about to launch in Brazil. We're in India. We're in China. So anywhere you are in the world, and check out if there's a meetup group already. And if not, take the initiative and find your tribe. Yeah.
I love that, man. That's a great challenge. Well, Joshua, thank you so much for coming on today. Really enjoyed our conversation, and hopefully this will be the first of many.
Look forward to more, Ted. Cheers, man.
That wraps up another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. And I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I know it's quite different from the more actionable and detailed things that we, or less deep conversations that we usually have on this show. When I have guests on, I usually like to focus on knowledge, information, and how to apply that information. And I think we did that here today, but it was from a deeper context, the context of the types of changes that are going on in society right now and how to navigate them, how to think about them. Should you be worried about them or not? And I think we should all be cognizant of what's going on, not necessarily worried about it. And we should all find our place in society and how to get through it and how to level up ourselves. And the big takeaway from this episode, from what Josh said, from my perspective as well, is that societal change starts with the individual. So if you're looking downstream, if you're looking at our political leaders or our celebrities or the craziness that's going on, that's the tip of the iceberg. And the foundation of all that is us, is each of us as individuals. And whether we choose to participate in society the way everybody else is, kind of like being a sheep and getting herded along, or if we start thinking for ourselves and start to step up in the way that we feel is true in our hearts, in our guts, wherever you get your intuition from. And that's what it's really about. And that's the big takeaway from today's episode for me. So if you've been listening to the show for a while, hit me up. Did you enjoy this conversation? Do you want more conversations like this on the show? I would love to hear you. Hit me up at my website, legendarylifepodcast.com, or on Instagram. By the way, I've been really active on Instagram. I've been putting up a lot of information. And if you're interested in following my travels, and you're not currently subscribed to my email list, make sure you go there, because I put stuff up on Instagram that I don't share anywhere else, especially on my Instagram stories, where I do these little videos showing you like the day-to-day life that I have while traveling. So make sure you go and check that out. And if you're new to the Legendary Life podcast, make sure you click that subscribe button. So every time one of my episodes goes live, you'll be the first to get it to your phone or wherever you listen to podcasts. So I hope you enjoy this a lot. These type of conversations, I'm not going to have them all the time on the show, but I think it's important that we all address this underlying, this tension that we all seem to have, especially in America, about where things are going, where society is going, where the world is going, where technology is taking us, and how to navigate that in a way where we're still having an amazing life. It's as simple as that. All right, I'm going to wrap things up. I hope you enjoyed it. I wish you an amazing week, and I'll speak to you soon.